Welcome again, listeners, to Season 5 of Food Conversations. Now, of course, before we begin, we once again acknowledge that we are living and working on the ancestral, unceded, and essentially stolen lands of the Shkwepnik people, and that fairly resolving this situation is an ongoing responsibility for us all. Today, I'm delighted to welcome all the way from Boston, Massachusetts, Sam Myers, Principal Research Scientist in Environmental Health at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, and a leading expert in the exploration of how the climate crisis is affecting food production and food quality around the world. Sam is also the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance, also based out of Harvard, a consortium of over 350 organizations of all kinds in over 60 countries around the world, focusing on, quote, protecting and regenerating Earth's natural systems for generations to come. Although Sam is also a board-certified internal medicine specialist, I think it's fair to say that his current and singular patient is now planet Earth, with a particular focus on the impacts on food production of a rapidly warming planet. Sam, welcome to Food Conversations.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
Delighted to have you. As I said earlier, and it's definitely true, you are bringing a special element to our program that I think will make our listeners really sit up and listen. Now, we were going to have a little conversation before the show, but you said you were crazy busy. And I think listeners would be interested to know what is a crazy busy Harvard public health physician and researcher do when he's running around like a chicken with his head cut off?
Well, I'm not sure there's one answer to that. I think everybody manages to be crazy busy in different ways. But for me, it means juggling a research program where we're exploring how environmental changes are affecting health and working with students and colleagues. And it also means running this global alliance that you mentioned, the Planetary Health Alliance, with partnerships and engagements all around the world. So there are lots of people that we're working with in lots of time zones and many, many projects. And what's exciting about that is every day looks completely different than the one before. And a lot of times the days are fairly hard to anticipate.
Always a pleasant pattern in one's life. If it's the same every day, it gets to be pretty but mundane and boring. Now, on our show, we often focus on local food issues, interviewing farmers, food processors, food retailers, local food advocacy organizations, and the people locally who foster and facilitate their work. But today we're going to broaden the scope of our analysis and discussion. Now, most of us have heard the expression, act locally, think globally, and that's a phrase that is central to just about everything Sam does on a day-to-day basis. But not everyone is aware of the long evolution of this phrase. It was originally put out by a brilliant Scottish town planner, Patrick Geddes, in 1915. And he was renowned for having a, quote, holistic, often profoundly spiritual approach to urban matters. People don't think of town planners as spiritual exponents. But Geddes, by the phrase, meant looking at every aspect of a project before taking a particular step. Look before you leap, in more complicated language. Including talking to the people directly affected by a new town plan. But this was, therefore, very much within the human community. Then in the 1970s, the scope of the phrase was expanded to environmental matters, meaning local actions in our communities that had to be carried out with an awareness of their effects on the natural world. Now, I think it's fair to say that today's sense of urgent concerns about what we're doing to our planetary home has led to an intense focus on more action, both global action as well as local action, and action at all levels in between. Now, Sam, you have been centrally involved with some major global actions. So let's begin by talking about one of them, the Planetary Health Alliance. Started up in 2015, there was an article in Lancet, the well-known medical journal, entitled Safeguarding Human Health in the Anthropocene Epoch. And you were one of 22 authors. which is a pretty large number of authors, not unheard of these days, but nevertheless a large group. And one of the phrases that struck me at the time was the sentence, "We have been mortgaging the health of future generations to realize economic and development gains in the present." So maybe you could talk a little bit about the context that was swirling around at that time that led to the Planetary Health Alliance being born.
Sure. Essentially, what was happening was that initially the Rockefeller Foundation, which has been sort of well known for its leadership going back 100 years in the field of public health, and really one of the sort of founding funders in the field of public health, was thinking about its centennial. And as part of that, their president, Judith Rodin, was looking for sort of big new ideas with scope to celebrate as part of the centennial, and also thinking about the evolution of the field of public health. And they shifted their focus to work being done by Richard Horton, who was the senior editor at The Lancet. And he'd written a couple of sort of commentaries about this idea of planetary health, and that the way our own activities are degrading and transforming all of our planet's natural systems is coming back to affect our own health and actually driving an urgent health crisis. She reached out to him. He spoke more about this idea. They decided that this was one of those big ideas they wanted to get behind, began to think about the idea of planetary health as sort of public health 2.0, and created this commission called the Rockefeller Lancet Commission on Planetary Health. We, as a commission, were brought together in a very swank sort of set of villas in Italy called Bellagio, where Rockefeller has a conference center. And we, as good academics do, cogitated for a week on this set of problems and began to develop a framework for how we would write this report. But in all seriousness...
And you were well fed.
And we were well fed and well taken care of in all ways. But, the next year we did a lot of writing. The goal was to try to write a comprehensive report that really focused in on this central problem that anthropogenic, human-caused environmental change, not only to the climate system, but to biodiversity and land use and pollution and all of these environmental changes were actually causing the degradation of our life support systems and therefore causing major impacts across human health around the world. And so we worked on that report. We were ready to publish it. And I felt like bringing out a major report sounding the alarm that our destruction of nature was imperiling the future of humanity was a little bit of a downer if we weren't going to say something that we actually wanted to do about it.
Yes, and
so
indeed.
I proposed we create the Planetary Health Alliance at that time.
Which has the following vision, and this is quoting from the sort of foundation document. "Our vision is a world where all people thrive by protecting and regenerating Earth's natural systems for generations to come." That's the kind of mandate that you couldn't just state it and walk away and say, well, that's solved the problem, we have a great vision. But then the mission is a little more down to earth. It says, "To promote, mobilize, and lead an inclusive transdisciplinary field of planetary health and its diverse science, stories, solutions, and communities to achieve the great transition." I want to make clear to listeners, this has nothing to do with the Davos event, the World Economic Forum, and Klaus Schwab. This is a much more meaningful exercise. And the great transition is a comprehensive shift in how human beings react or interact with each other and with nature. What kind of hand did you have in some of these phrases that were developed? I mean, I know it was a consensus document, but what was the process like of preparing those fairly elevated, lofty vision and mission statements?
Yeah, so I had a pretty central hand in that. I mean, the Planetary Health Alliance, as you mentioned, includes over 350 organizations now in over 65 countries. But we have a secretariat here at Harvard that sort of tries to drive things forward with permission from our alliance members. And when we sat down to work on our vision and mission, it was really our core team that did the drafting. It would have been pretty hard to draft a mission
yes,
with 350
22.
alliance members. And yeah, I understand that the language sounds lofty. I think as you start to parse it, it actually is very pragmatic.
Yeah.
And it comes from the fundamental reality that our own activities are driving a global earth crisis, and the earth crisis has reached a scale that is imperiling the health of all people everywhere. And so if we want a livable future for our children, the only way we're going to get that, in fact, is by shifting the way we live to reduce our ecological footprint, which is going to allow us to protect and regenerate our life support system. So it sounds lofty, but it's actually pretty practical and pretty essential if we're going to have a livable future.
I remind listeners once again that I'm talking to Sam Myers, who's the principal research scientist in environmental health at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance. Sam, I wanted to draw attention to one thing that's part of the mission statement, and that is the inclusion of the word stories. There's a tendency in scientific circles, academic circles, to talk disparagingly about the anecdotal evidence for things. And yet stories are a profoundly important anecdotal evidence. I always say if you like the story, then you call it an N equals one experiment or observation. If you don't like it, you call it anecdotal, and that's kind of denigrating it. Why was the word stories included? Which I think is a very positive thing, by the way.
I think for a couple of reasons. One is that we, in creating the Planetary Health Alliance, are creating a very large umbrella, and we want to bring all manner of people in under that umbrella, not only Western scientists, but indigenous peoples, arts and humanitarians, faith leaders, you know, youth networks. And so people make meaning in a lot of different ways. And in my community at the School of Public Health, we do a lot of epidemiology, and there's a sort of scientific approach to thinking about the health of populations. But other people make meaning in other ways. And so that's one reason. The second reason is that maybe more profound, which is that at the end of the day, yes, we're facing an earth crisis, and yes, that earth crisis is precipitating a global health and humanitarian crisis. But underneath both of those, I would argue that we're experiencing a crisis of our stories, and that we are living broken stories in terms of our relationship to nature and to each other, and that there may be something deeper there that really is important to acknowledge, that we need new stories if we're going to have the kind of paradigm shift that we really need. It's not just about technology and innovation. And so we wanted to make room for that possibility in our definition.
Well, I think it's quite clear that the initiative has resonated with a lot of people, because I checked it out. There's 1,226 citations of the founding document that I think tells a story in itself. In addition to the pragmatic nature of the organization, there's also a subgroup which is very clearly pragmatic. It's called the Clinicians for Planetary Health Working Group. I'm delighted to be able to say that CAPE, the Canadian Association of Physicians for the Environment, has representation on that group and has had involvement with the whole process from the beginning, which makes me as a physician, and I'm sure you as a physician, all the physicians in the world, pleased to see that we're stepping out of our offices and private places into the world and recognize that we have a broader role to play in the community. Do you think about that kind of thing, how physicians need to do more than just one patient at a time. Obviously, public health, that's the mandate of public health, is population health. But as for the profession as a whole, does that sometimes cross your mind?
Yeah, absolutely it does. And I wouldn't restrict the conversation to physicians. In fact, I think that physicians are often, at least in the United States, the last clinicians to sort of get their head up and realize that there's a bigger world around them. It's been really, really exciting to see the nursing community leading in this area as well. But there are a lot of reasons why having clinicians engaged in planetary health is important. One is that we're sort of on the front lines of seeing changing patterns of disease. And so, recognizing that Lyme disease, where I live, is moving north and west in response to changing temperatures, or that we're seeing, Mesoamerican nephropathy in workers forced to do agricultural labor, for example, maybe in areas where you are, as it gets much hotter and they're experiencing heat stress that can lead to kidney failure, that we're the ones who can see that first, and we need to call attention to it. We're also the most trusted messengers in the world, whether we deserve it or not. And in particular, nurses, 17 years in a row have been the most trusted messengers in the United States, most trusted messengers globally. And we carry a very, very important message that this is not about polar bears and, losing high alpine species. This is about whether our children are going to have a livable future. And so being trusted messengers with a message that actually resonates around the world, and also having access to just about everybody on the planet, we touch collectively almost everybody as clinicians, means that we have an important role to play in getting the message out.
Yes, I couldn't agree more. And I would also agree with your codicil that whether we deserve it or not, sometimes our profession sort of skates off into a rarefied world and doesn't really address the fact that we are humans, biological creatures living on a highly sensitive ecosystem, little orb floating around in space. I had a conversation with a biologist who was part of PANA, Pesticide Action Network of North America, some years ago, who said, with tears in her eyes, I've been talking about earthworms and protecting them and how they're a kind of a sub-indicator species. And you guys come along and talk about children getting sick, and suddenly everybody's interested, and after 20 years, they're still not interested in earthworms. So we have a bit of a cachet, which I think we ought to shamelessly exploit, and I encourage my physician colleagues to take advantage of that credibility to use it to advance things and move them forward. Now, we're talking about very high-level accomplishments, but you, like the rest of us, started out in a different space and with a different awareness of things. Our early years shape us later, but we don't always see how it's happening. You were born and raised in Boston. Your family wasn't an environmentalist family in any particular way, or an advocacy family. What sort of milieu did you find yourself in? What family did you choose?
Well, I grew up right smack in the middle of a pretty urban area in Boston, went to the Boston Public Schools in the middle of the big busing crisis, which was all about sort of desegregation of schools under a federal order to integrate the Boston Public Schools. It was a sort of dark time in Indeed. Boston's history. So I was, in the middle of that, and in a pretty urban environment. But that said, my parents came from, my dad was sort of from the desert in Arizona. My mom was from Oregon. They both loved to be outdoors. And so we did get out, and my grandmother had moved to
Cape Cod.
What would probably seem like a fairly rural area to your listeners, in Cape Cod, sort of out on the very tip of a sort of spit of land that goes well out into the ocean outside of Massachusetts. And we spent a lot of time out there, and that became sort of a sanctuary for me growing up, starting at about the age of three. And then we spent time up in the White Mountains in New Hampshire. So we did get out, and when we did those spaces really resonated with me.
And one part of that time was actually being out on your own in the woods, listening to the sound of rustling streams and just being connected to the kind of the gestalt, if you like, of Mother Nature. How do you remember that? How do you see it as a current, pardon the word, flowing through now till today? Because all these experiences tend to do that. They tend to stay with us.
Yeah, I mean, I think I was aware at a pretty young age of a relationship to the natural world that was compelling to me, and of experiences in nature by myself that we don't have great words to articulate, but I think, you know, reverence and awe are probably the closest words that we have, and a sense of being able to sort of lose oneself in those places, or sort of feel oneself kind of merging with something larger than the boundaries of your physical body. And so I think that I experienced that as a fairly powerful connection to nature without really making a whole lot of it at the time, or knowing in any way that I wanted to do anything with it. But it was just part of my sort of childhood experience that that moved me.
Yeah, I think we don't always understand how powerful these experiences are until a lot later in life. And we're going to talk about the Constellation Project, which is kind of a return to that sense of awe and wonder, something that many scientists eventually achieve in their career. I remind listeners once again that I'm talking to Sam Myers, who's the principal research scientist in environmental health at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance. Now, of course, when you leave school, high school, you got to do something. I'm sure that was something that figured in your consciousness at that point. And you had a sort of an interest in medicine, but it was something to do. What direction did you find yourself taking at that point?
You went well, to Yale. I found myself getting on the subway and going to Harvard. So it wasn't very far away. And, you know, it's funny watching my kids now making decisions about where to go to college. It's a whole nother world. But for me, it was, you know, where my brother had gone, and it was the sort of local university, and it seemed like it would do. And so I went off to go to college, and in college spent time really interested in biology all the way from the sort of you know, molecular biochemistry up to ecology, and found the whole sort of system so impressive and exciting and sort of unimaginable in its complexity as you start to understand what's happening inside these cells. And so I thought that was really, really, really cool. And then I was sort of had a quandary about what that meant professionally, and did I want to be a biologist or a wildlife veterinarian or a physician? You know, it took a while to sort of sort that out. And one of my sort of early mentors was E.O. Wilson, who was teaching at Harvard at the time, the best course that I ever took in evolutionary biology. And I spent a lot of time just going to his office hours and talking with him. And it was he who advised me to go to medical school, given my interest in medicine, and then see if there was a way to sort of make the synthesis between that and my interest in the broader natural world.
Why did E.O. Wilson, who's not a healthcare professional, why did he feel that that was a good place for you to go?
Well, I had expressed an interest in understanding how changes in our planet's natural systems actually related to our own health and well-being. And He basically said, look, you can go be a biologist and you'll spend, 6 or 7 years studying some mollusk in some bay somewhere in, excruciating detail, and you'll come out with a credential. But if you study medicine, it's a broader education, and you'll also have a kind of credibility in coming to understand how the health of people connects to nature if you can figure it out, if you can make the synthesis. But that, and if you can't, his feeling was that a career in medicine was better aligned with the person he'd gotten to know than a career in pure biology. So I think that was just what he thought made sense for me.
It's interesting that he also, as we talked about earlier, recognized that as a physician, if you got it, as it were, if you understood the essence of what you were learning and how powerful it was, that you would be able to command more attention and move more levers. I wonder if that's a bit of sadness that some biologists have, that they see upfront the intricacies of part of the biological world, but when they speak, they don't get the same platform to address that we physicians are granted almost,
Yeah, I mean, it's possible, but I think, I mean, it's not confusing, right? That people care about people first. And
Indeed.
so if you're trying to get people to care about ants or mollusks, it's going to be more of an uphill battle than if you're trying to get them to care about their grandchildren. And so ultimately, this is what we've learned, is that we need to understand how these issues come down to affect our own
Indeed.
well-being. And that's not to say there aren't people out there who care about other things. Certainly there are, but first and foremost, that's what most people care about.
Well, despite a very enlivening experience with one of the world leaders in, of course, the concept of biophilia, which is one that E.O. Wilson has presented to the world in many ways, you ended up studying medicine at Yale and started to get a sense of what environmental science was, sort of percolating around somewhere in the world around you. But why don't you talk about that? Because then you went to California.
Well, so I chose to go to Yale because they had one of the strongest schools of forestry and environmental science alongside a medical school that had no grades and no class ranking the first 2 years. And I figured that was a really
That's a
good
bonus. That's a
combination
bonus.
for spending a lot of time up at the forestry school. And that's in fact what I ended up doing. So, really, my social life revolved around that school much more than the medical school. And I ended up playing on, their intramural, soccer teams and ultimate frisbee teams and going to their parties. And I was kind of a parasite. And I would go to these, events and parties and ask people what they were learning about and what they were studying. And it was a wonderful way to get sort of a fix on issues in environmental science while I was ostensibly studying medicine.
You
So
were you were
it worked
ruining
out
your
well.
chance. You were ruining your chance of being unidisciplinary. You were
I
compelling
was.
yourself into a world of transdisciplinary studies, perforce.
Yeah, I think I decided that unidisciplinarity was overrated very early on.
It's very much overrated. I concur entirely. Then you went to California and UCSF, and that was for a year, right? And it was the plan was for,
Well,
well,
I
it ended
went
up
to
being a
do a
year.
3-year internal medicine residency, and I was there for actually, it was in my second year of residency that I ended up meeting a delegation of Tibetans
So,
and then taking 2 years off.
okay, you have to give a few forensic details of that wonderful meal you had that precipitated you vaulting across the Pacific Ocean.
Yeah, well, so when I'd been at Yale, one of the people I'd gotten to know up at the School of Forestry and Environmental Sciences ultimately went on to help create a brand new national park on the north side of Mount Everest in
what had become the Tibet Autonomous Region after China's invasion of Tibet. And so they created this great big new national park the size of Denmark called the Chomolungma Nature Preserve. And he had been very involved in sort of conceptualizing the park and thinking about how to manage it with Tibetans and Chinese. And then he brought a delegation of Tibetans to visit the Western United States to look at our park system. And he showed up in San Francisco hosting a dinner and asked me if I could get out of residency for dinner that night. And that's all I knew.
And you said it was a free meal. I'll come.
Like any good medical student, I'll do anything for free food. And so I sat down to dinner and discovered that I was sitting next to the vice chair of the Communist Party for the Tibet Autonomous Region, which means he was sort of one of the most senior people running the country. And on my other side was a woman who was the health minister for Tibet. And I had been very clearly positioned in a way that I had not known, to be sitting next to this health minister who, early on in the dinner turned to me and asked me if I would consider coming to Tibet to become the field manager for a brand new project they wanted to develop, called the Pendaba Project, to train village-based health workers in both primary health care and conservation.
Sam, this sounds like the most unusual blind date in the world.
Yeah, especially since I didn't even know I was going on a date.
No, you were hoodwinked. You were hoodwinked.
It was, so it was pretty interesting. And I tried very hard early on in the conversation to convince this health minister that she had the wrong person for the job, that I knew absolutely nothing at all about how to run a project like that, nor did I have any relevant experience, having never been anywhere in, you know, the global South or in a lower income country. And I'm certainly not anywhere near Tibet. And I hadn't been trained in any of the relevant disciplines, public health, you know, organizing. You know, I was getting trained to work in a tertiary healthcare system in the United States. She persevered.
How many times did she ask you? How am I talking?
Well, she asked me twice. And after she asked me the second time, I told her that I felt pretty strongly that I was the wrong person for the job. And that if she asked me again, I was going to say yes. And then she was going to have the wrong person in the job. And she asked me a third time and I said yes. And then I had to somewhat sheepishly go the next morning to my residency director and explain that I'd been at a dinner that night and just agreed to go spend 2 years living in Tibet and running this new project. And was there any chance they might be willing to hold me a spot so that I could come back in 2 years and finish my residency?
And he said?
And he said, yeah, we will. We will. So that
you
was
had no
surprising.
Excuse to, you had no excuse to not go. There were all these pins were being taken away from under you. You were collapsing in a heap.
Exactly.
So you went to Tibet, and Tibet is a very different country, different culture, different socioeconomic status. What was it like for a young man who has spent time in the wilds of New Hampshire and the forests of Cape Cod? What's that like to go to this very, very different social and biological ecosystem?
I mean, it was really, really hard. It was exciting and terrifying and ultimately very hard. I'd gotten funding for this program from the Echoing Green Foundation. I had received donations of pharmaceuticals, particularly antibiotics, which I'd heard would be needed in Tibet. And I arrived in Lhasa with seven boxes of donated pharmaceuticals and things that were sort of, each one was about the size of me, and promptly was stopped by customs and told that I had to pay some exorbitant duty on these donated pharmaceuticals, and I didn't have any money. The person who was supposed to meet me in the Lhasa airport never showed up, and So I started out my experience in Tibet by sitting on the concrete floor in the airport, sort of saying, I'm here, I don't have extra money, I have these boxes, you can transport me somewhere else if you want, but I'm not
Yes.
going anywhere. And
If you
after
have to
about
shoot me,
12
go
hours,
ahead. If you have to shoot me, go
exactly.
ahead.
No, I mean, I didn't know what else to do. And after about 12 hours, they sort of tired of me and let me go with my boxes. And it was 2 years of physically very challenging living, and emotionally much more challenging, in the sense that I was a 2 day jeep ride from any other English speakers in any direction, except for the interpreter that I was working with. And so it was very, very lonely. I was living at 16,000 feet, no power, no hot water. So, it was not an easy transition. But it was also just extraordinarily educational to see how differently people might live in the world, and to also see, the extraordinary warmth and humor and happiness of people living with tiny, tiny fractions of what we consider
Indeed.
absolutely necessary for our well-being.
Indeed. Which you would later learn were people who are contributing dramatically less than we in this part of the world to the climate crisis and various other things. Remind listeners once again that I'm talking to Sam Myers, Principal Research Scientist at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and the founding director of the Planetary Health Alliance. If you look back on that experience in Tibet, that kind of seminal, whether you liked it to be seminal or not, it was just a major intrusion into your consciousness from a different angle. What do you think it left you with in terms of a reorientation of your thinking about the world?
I mean, on the one hand, I think it was seminal in the sense that it left me with a conviction that there was a very large share of the world's people living with very, very little, and in conditions that were very vulnerable to changing environmental conditions. I think it started me down a path that ultimately I think was a misdirection, in the sense that it got me interested in how to work in lower income country settings, which I did for the next several years, to make the connection between the protection of natural resources and systems and people's well-being. And it took me an embarrassingly long time to understand that those connections were much more profoundly intuitive to the people living there than they could ever be for me, and that what was preventing them from protecting forests, or later on it was coral reefs or mangrove systems, was not that they didn't understand how integral those systems were for their health and well-being, but that they had 0 degrees of freedom in the decisions that they were making, and
For
that they
sure.
were dynamiting their reefs or using cyanide for fishing because they needed to feed their kids the next day, and that was the only way they were going to do it.
Absolutely, and that kind of imperative is something that one can be insulated from in a wealthy industrial society. But unfortunately, it's the person who is dynamiting the reef who is probably closer to planetary realities, but shaped by human realities as well. I couldn't agree more that this kind of disconnect between two worlds almost is a profoundly significant one, and it's ridiculous for someone who's like us, wealthy and secure, to say to a poor peasant in Nicaragua, please don't go to the nearby nature reserve and cut down trees to have wood to burn in your kitchen to cook your food, unless we are prepared to say we would never do that, which we know is entirely wrong. We would be doing it just as much as they would. So let's move on a little bit to a part of your world that has become central and in which you've played a very active role. That's your role as principal research scientist, environmental health at the Chan School. Your research has, and this is food conversations, so we should talk about food, has been on some of the things that the climate crisis is doing to the food supply and what the food supply and the way we generate it is doing to the climate crisis, because they're kind of interlocked and reciprocal. One important area that you've looked at is pollinators. Pollinators play a role that's unsung and often invisible. We pay attention to pollinators if one of them stings us or if they buzz too near our head. But there are a whole range of pollinators, and they play a critical role in food development. And their disappearance is related to a loss of biodiversity. So what's been your research in this area in terms of underlining this issue in red ink?
Yeah, well, first of all, I would say that I would expand the framing, because I would say this isn't really about the climate crisis. I would say this is about sort of the earth crisis, and that, in fact, what's driving pollinators down and what's driving what people are calling the insect apocalypse around the world is actually primarily loss of habitat and forage. It's land use change, it's use of pesticides. And, you know, now it's increasingly climate change is one of those drivers, but it's not the dominant driver affecting biodiversity loss.
Yeah, and that's I just want to underline that point, because in Germany, for example, the incredible loss of insect numbers, volume, and diversity is actually clearly multifactorial and has a lot to do with how people grow food and do and live their lives. So,
So in terms of the research, what got us really interested was that we knew that pollinators are responsible for a large share of the calories in the diet and also a large share of the nutrients in the diet. And we wanted to know how insufficient wild pollinators were affecting global health, because we know that pollinators are really important for the production of foods that protect us from very common diseases like heart disease, stroke, diabetes, and some cancers, and that eating less of those foods like fruits, vegetables, and nuts actually puts us at higher risk of mortality from those diseases. And so our research was really to look at how the existing declines in pollinators are affecting mortality from those diseases around the world.
I'm so glad that you broadened the scope of the scenario, because it is a weakness to get attached to one issue and then advance it and develop it. Maybe it's what E.O. Wilson was saying. You get stuck if you were a biologist, but in your current position, you can really cheerfully and enthusiastically broaden the scope. Well, there's a couple of matters that I'd really like to get onto. One is the incorporation of indigenous values and processes and perspectives into the world of food, but in fact, the whole earth challenge that we're facing right now. But I just wanted to mention one, or have you lay out a few comments about one other aspect of your research that's been quite important, that is the impact of carbon dioxide levels on nutrient density in a variety of different foodstuffs, particularly grains. Could you just outline briefly what you found and what you've been able to say isn't happening?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, first, just to finish on pollinators, to get to the punchline, you know, what we actually found in that research was that we're experiencing about 500,000 deaths every year today because we don't have enough wild pollinators to maximize the production of the foods that we depend on to keep us healthy. So that was sort of the finding in the study we published a few months ago.
Sure.
But yeah, another area that we've done research is to show how rising concentrations of carbon dioxide in the atmosphere are actually affecting the nutritional value of the food that we eat. And when we've grown crops at elevated CO2 levels that we expect to reach by about the middle of this century, so not crazy high levels, what we find is that those crops grown in open field conditions, they're not grown in chambers or greenhouses, at elevated CO2,
have lower amounts of really important nutrients for human health, like iron and zinc and protein. And we've spent the last several years modeling how those changes in the nutritional value of the food that we eat will affect the total nutrient intake for populations all across the world. And we've found that about 150 to 200 million people are likely to be pushed into new risk for deficiencies of those nutrients, in addition to the sort of billion or so people who already have nutritional deficiencies, which would be exacerbated. So it's a pretty significant health effect. It's also actually, by the way, not a climate effect. Even though we're talking about CO2, it's a direct effect of carbon dioxide on the plants. It's not mediated through the climate. So it's
Yes.
another example of how biophysical changes that we're creating in the world are coming back to affect our own health and well-being.
So it's actually showing that one of the precipitants of climate change, which is CO2 concentration, has another aspect that we would ignore at our peril. And you also made the point in your discussion of this research that I was reading that even though the loss is of these key nutrients like iron and zinc and protein and some of the B vitamins as well is fairly modest if you're looking at the percentage, it's 10, 15, 20%. But when you add that to an already straitened dietary pattern, it becomes much more, and in fact, sometimes quite radically significant, which I think is, which is a very good point. Greta Thunberg has put together a book called The Climate Book, not surprisingly, which officially was supposed to come out in February of this year. Do you know if it's done that?
It is. It's out.
It's
Yep.
out.
It's out both in Europe and in the US. I don't know about Canada.
And you, in that, have written an essay summarizing your research and commenting. You commented when you're describing this on your website that you were impressed by. And I think the world is impressed by Greta Thunberg's moral authority. And I wondered, how does somebody, an unusual person like Greta Thunberg, have a Harvard researcher get on board with her new book? Does she just call you up and say, "Hi, this is Greta. Could we have an essay from you for her book?"
No, she has her publisher do that.
Yes, my people speak to your people. Well, I actually fantasize it was probably more like that. But at any rate, if readers want to, listeners rather, want to read a good source which contains this essay by Sam Myers, it's called The Climate Book. I'm sure it's out. If it's not out in Canada, then Amazon does cross the border. You also commented on her activists' impatience. And maybe we could start talking a little bit about the sort of moral side of most environmental work. And in that side, impatience plays a role. And I think most of us who've been involved with these kinds of issues has a sense of urgency, and that leads to impatience and drumming your fingers on the table, if mentally, if not physically. And one way to make that process of change accelerate is to incorporate indigenous ways of looking at the world, which have been available to us forever, as it were, but which we have ignored. And I'm referring specifically, maybe you talk about a book that was written by Nicole Redvers, who is herself indigenous. She's Dene from northern Canada. And she's interestingly a naturopathic physician. And for many years, as you know, in our profession, we've been a bit skeptical about naturopathy and somewhat dismissive at times. And I'm delighted to see that a naturopathic physician can play such an important role. She's on the board of the Planetary Health Alliance. She's not on the board, but she's involved with it directly. And I wonder if you could comment a little bit. Here's a sentence from the description of The Science of the Sacred, a book that Nicole Redvers wrote. And it says this: "Modern medical science has finally caught up to what traditional healing systems have known for centuries. Many traditional healing techniques and medicines are often assumed to be archaic, outdated, or unscientific compared to modern Western medicine." There's a holism, a social holism emerging these days. A naturopathic woman, indigenous clinician, is now bringing to the waiting Caucasian settler world, if you like it, the colonial world, insights that we are finally realizing are critical to our understanding of what we have to do next. Does that help salve your impatience? And Greta Thunberg's, you can speak for her too.
Well, it's going to take a lot to solve my impatience. So, you know, when you talk about urgency and impatience, you know, I think that is actually a rational response. If we're standing on the side of a road with all of our children in a bus and they're driving straight towards a cliff and nobody's changing their direction and nobody's slowing them down, we ought to feel pretty impatient. So I think that's rational. In terms of Nicole, who is on our steering committee and has been wonderful at helping to guide the Planetary Health Alliance, a really important member of our community, she is not alone. And in fact, earlier this week, I was at the United Nations Permanent Forum on Indigenous Issues as one of two speakers, with the release of a new report on the Indigenous Determinants of Health. And it's really an important breakthrough report, in my opinion, which states, among many other things, that, you know, we believe the health of the land and the health of the people are synonymous. Mm-hmm. And there are a lot of statements about that holistic perspective that you articulated that run through the report. It was written by Indigenous representatives from all over the world. And it speaks to, you know, this idea of decolonizing healthcare, which is something that I hadn't really understood as a concept until I started to read about Indigenous determinants of health. And that fundamentally, if you see your own self as much bigger than the boundaries of your body and fully integrated with the ecosystem you're in, and you see health of yourself and your community as synonymous with the health of the land, then a system that doesn't see any of that, that's colonized healthcare, is really a problem. And what's exciting about planetary health is that it actually has, from a sort of Western science standpoint, converged on the exact same conclusion that the health of the land and the health of the people are synonymous. And so there's this interesting sort of alliance that's happening between the Western scientific community and planetary health and Indigenous perspectives on what health actually is.
I totally appreciate the passion that arose in your voice as you just talked about this, because it's something that I think many people share. I certainly do myself, this sense that we have to move and we have to integrate and bring together different channels, different paths to meet at the top of the mountain. One way that you have been formally working on that is through a project called the Constellation Project, a collaboration between the Harvard Divinity School, the Planetary Health Alliance, and the Chan School of Public Health, as well as the Harvard Center for Environment. And interesting, the Center for the Study of World Religions. Now, I had hoped to have you read something you very poetically wrote in a little publication called The Wings of Herons. I'm going to just read myself a little poem that begins this very small but eloquent volume. It goes like this: we are witnessing a world changing beyond hope. Bless us and bless our children. Wash their sweet bodies with snow. Place our hands on the pulse of a dying lake. Watch the wings of herons burst into flames. It's a very evocative six lines of poetic thought. Maybe as we close, you could just share where you think things will go, must go, can go as we move along this trajectory.
Well, so the Constellation Project is a partnership that really came out of cups of tea between Terry Tempest Williams and me over the years. And for people that want to read those essays, they're found at the Planetary Health Alliance website, so it's easy to find them.
And they really come from this idea that at the foundation of the moment we're in, there's a need for new stories. And so part of the Constellation Project is to offer up new stories into the night sky to help guide us toward a different future.
Sam Myers, it's been a delight, absolute delight to have you on the show. Your articulation and your depth of understanding and your deep devotion to what you're doing is apparent to all our listeners. I thank you very much for being with us today.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thanks so much.